No, he orders you for the week. That's right.
No, he's over here.
Our carrier is here.
Why?
See, this is reverse.
Oh, I see.
It's reverse.
Yeah.
It's over here.
Well, if it's reverse, he'd be over here.
Yeah,
he'd be right over here.
Our carrier is there.
Yeah. Who is this? Well, then these are from my site instead of from your site.
Well, I gotta go ahead.
Never mind.
You don't have a copy of the site.
Yeah, I had it on my desk to bring it. I said, I'll forget.
No, never mind.
I'll get it off the book.
I'll read it from
Mr. Legal, would you lead us in prayer this morning, please? It's hard in planning an assignment to know just how long. And of course, an assignment like I gave today, a person might conceivably spend considerable time on. But I would think that most of you would be able to read these passages fairly quickly. They're fairly simple passages. And to answer the questions I ask, either with nothing or with a specific answer, fairly quickly. I'd like to look at them with you now. The first, and incidentally, if you don't have it right, don't worry about it at all, because the purpose of these particular assignments is to prepare you for the discussion in class. Rather, it's not to test you in any sense. I'm interested in whether you do the assignment, and I keep careful track of that. But as to whether you get the answer that I think is correct or not, if you all could get it immediately, we wouldn't have people look at it in class, of course. But I'm interested in looking at your papers to see how many of you have gotten it, and then I want to look it over with you now. And so, Obi, one second. I had a sheet of paper left on my desk and I had to bring with me. I had the assignment for next time written out, and I forgot to bring it with me. I think I'll give it to you now, but I'll have to ask you to look. And here I have it right in front of me. It's chapter 22. Next time, I'd like you to look at chapter 22 of Jeremiah. And looking at chapter 22, I would like you to see who are the kings who are mentioned in the chapter. Who are the kings who are mentioned in the chapter? Where do we learn something about them? Now, some of these kings are called by more than one name. But I think you'll easily find evidence on that either in a footnote in your Bible or in a Bible dictionary. Probably a footnote. The Bible will tell you in case there's a different name from the most common one. But what kings are named in chapter 22, and where in the Bible do we learn about them? Learn their history. You will find their history, and you will find that, of course, easily in any concordance. So I would like you to simply give a brief statement about the kings of Judah that Jeremiah makes predictions about in chapter 22. And where in Kings or Chronicles or both you find the facts given about that. Now that's the assignment for next time. I won't bother to post it because I think it's fairly short and fairly clear. Now the first of these questions then for today was to look at Jeremiah 11. And in Jeremiah 11, the first question was the character of the particular king. And of course you notice that this, in this chapter, the king who, no, it wasn't Jeremiah, it was Jeremiah 21. In Jeremiah 21, the king who is discussed is Zedekiah. And you notice that Zedekiah here was interested in knowing what the will of the Lord was. So he was a king who had at least some belief in God. He had an interest in knowing what the Lord's will was. And then the second question was the character of the leading officials. And I don't think you learned anything about that from this chapter. The third question was the means God used to protect Jeremiah. And here again, there's either nothing told or that the king certainly did not try to injure Jeremiah. The king showed a certain amount of favor to him. The fourth question, light on how the book of Jeremiah was formed. You get information from this chapter, but you might need another chapter, a later chapter that I assigned, to notice it. So whether you told under this chapter or under the later chapter doesn't matter. But the fact is that Zedekiah here is the important king in this chapter. And as I told you last time, most of Zedekiah's ministry was in the reign of three kings, Josiah, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah. And this is the last of the three. And so when you strike him as early as chapter 21, it would suggest that the arrangement of the book is not strictly chronological. It would suggest that. When you come to a later chapter and find that there you're dealing not with Zedekiah but an earlier king, there you get clear proof that the book is not chronologically arranged, as are most of the books of most of the other prophetic books are chronologically arranged. But here you have not merely a reference to King Zedekiah, but an event in his reign, which is described before events are described in the reign of an earlier king. Then the second passage was Jeremiah 26. That was an interesting event. In fact, there were two rather important events in it. Jehoiakim made an attempt to get Jeremiah killed, and he succeeded in getting another prophet killed, who we are told made predictions very similar to Jeremiah's. So here, in answer to the first question, you find that the character of this king was that he was a vicious enemy of God and of God's prophet, that he desired to destroy God's prophets. So that you have very clear evidence here, the answer to the first question. The answer to the second question, of course, is also clear, that Jehoiakim's officials protected Jeremiah. They interfered. They made arguments to the king. They protected Jeremiah, even though the king's hatred of what Jeremiah was saying was so great that the king sent clear to Egypt to capture another prophet who was saying substantially the same thing as Jeremiah did, and to have him brought back and killed. So you have very definite evidence as to the character of Jehoiakim and evidence that he had officials who interfered with his doing what he desired. And then third, the means God used to protect Jeremiah, it was, of course, through godly officials in the kingdom. We have clear evidence here that this was not an absolute monarchy. That while the king had very great power, his power was greatly affected by the attitudes of his leading officials. And then fourth, the way the book of Jeremiah was formed, again, here is an event in the reign of Jehoiakim, and in fact early in his reign. I told you last time he reigned 11 years. This, we're told, was in the fourth year of his reign. And the previous chapter told about an event in the reign of Zedekiah. So you don't get much information, but you get a little information about the way the book was formed here. Then the next was chapter 36. And chapter 36 had a very interesting event, an event which must have occurred after the event described in chapter 26. There was a situation in which Jeremiah thought it unwise to appear personally before the king. And that would suggest strongly that the previous event had occurred. And Jeremiah dictated his prophecy. And by the way, that word prophecy, as used today, generally means a prediction of a future event. The Greek word to prophesy simply means to speak out, to present a message. It does not necessarily mean a prophetic message, a predicted message. And so in the Bible, while the prophet's work includes prediction, that is by no means all of it. In fact, it is I shouldn't say a small part, but it is certainly far less than half of the prophecies are actually predictive. But the prophecies of Jeremiah, the statements he had made denouncing the sin of the nation, these statements had already affected Jehoiakim to such an extent that he did not wish publicly to appear at this time. But he dictated this material to Barak, and then Barak read it publicly, and we found that the officials wanted the king to read it. And then when the king wanted to destroy it, the officials tried to stop him from destroying it. But the king went ahead and destroyed it anyway. But that Jeremiah hid, and he redictated the material, and we read, and many other like words he included in the new scroll. And so we learn from that, number one, the character of Jehoiakim, already clear from the previous chapter, is made even clearer in this chapter. The character of the leading officials already suggested in the previous chapter is here equally strongly suggested. The means God used to protect Jeremiah here is two parts, having the officials to protect him, and also causing Jeremiah to hide rather than showing himself at this juncture. You had a question there?
Yes, in verse 24, I put that to suggest that the officials weren't, you had the reverence for God's word that might be desired, and if they did not respond, they came back and burned the scroll by bringing their bodies.
Verse 24 says the king and all his attendants. But I think it's quite evident that the other officials were not included in his attendants. His attendants would be those who were closest to him. But they wouldn't necessarily mean they were the most powerful ones. You might say that President Reagan's attendants would be the members of his staff, of his White House staff, who have a great deal of power, but the cabinet officials have more power than they do. And they would be leading officials. Now these attendants might or might not be leading officials. Now, I think that the people whom he could choose to be his close attendants would be pretty similar in character to himself. They would be who he wanted. But there might be leading officials whom he had not selected. And so then the way that God protected Jeremiah was twofold. By having important officials who protected him, and by causing Jeremiah to hide. Some people think it would be the duty of a man in Jeremiah's situation to come out publicly and expose himself. But the Bible shows that there are times when one should expose himself, and there are times when one can do God's work best by avoiding danger. Now the fourth point, on which we had little evidence up to this point, you have a great deal in this chapter. We find in this chapter that Jeremiah wrote these things in a scroll specifically for this occasion. Whether he ever had written anything down before in any permanent form, we do not know. But it is obvious here that Jeremiah thought back over what he had said at various times, over the messages God had given him, and he wrote them down. And they were destroyed, and he rewrote them, but he added many other words, many other similar words. And this suggests that the book of Jeremiah does not represent what God gave the prophet one year and the next and so on through, but that it begins with such a writing, and then that when he rewrote it, he inserted various matters into it. And of course, the first passage we looked at, the account of an event in the time of Zedekiah, he could not have inserted then because that was 7 years before Zedekiah became king. And so it is clear that he later made certain insertions, either he did or Barak did, when he was making a final copy of it. So this chapter is very important in giving us an idea of just how the book of Jeremiah was formed. Then I ask you to look at chapter 38. And chapter 38, we find again Zedekiah. But we have more information about Zedekiah here. We have his officials wanting Jeremiah killed. And we have Zedekiah not telling them there's nothing he can do to oppose them, that they can do what they want. So we find the officials here having great power, but nevertheless not going completely against what was clearly Zedekiah's desire. They didn't kill him, but they put him into a dungeon. They hoped he would die of natural causes, but they were not ready to oppose what was obviously the king's desire to the extent of killing him. And we find the king talking to Jeremiah and desirous of finding out what Jeremiah wants, but afraid of his life to have the officials know what Jeremiah was actually telling him. And so we have a situation here that shows the character of Zedekiah. It does not show him as an overtly wicked man. My inclination is to think that Zedekiah was a man who under normal circumstances would have been a good man. That he was a man who under normal circumstances would have drifted along doing, following what he thought was the Lord's will and desirous of promoting those who were supporting God's purposes. But he had officials who were very strongly opposed to him. And he was afraid of these officials. He was a timid man. He was one who was in a rather difficult situation and one who hid his real desires. And there are many rulers in history who've been in that situation. There are many officials in every sort of organization who from time to time find themselves in that position. The number of completely absolute rulers in the world's history is comparatively small. They have to have not only a system which gives them the right to be absolute rulers, but they have to have the power and the personality to oppose whatever opposes them and to maintain their power, and no matter how great the opposition to them would become. So Zedekiah, I think, was a man who in normal times could easily get the reputation of being a good man. Now in Kings, where it speaks of him, it says that he did evil in the sight of the Lord. And he certainly did evil in the sight of the Lord. He was a man who did not have the character to resist the difficulties that he faced and to stand for the Lord in a difficult situation. But we find that his officials were quite a different type. Yes, you had a question?
Were officials carried over from one reign to another?
It would seem so. It would seem very definitely so. We do not have specific statements here on it, but it would seem quite obvious from the way things happen here that those who were put in positions of great authority and importance, that it was pretty hard for a man to get rid of. I don't suppose any of you remember the day, as I do, when President Roosevelt died. And when he died, the vice president, Truman, who then immediately became president, immediately announced that he would like all of President Roosevelt's cabinet to remain, that he had great respect for all these men whom Roosevelt had appointed as officials, leaders of the cabinet, leaders of the government, and that he would hope they would all remain and assist him in carrying on the difficult duties of the presidency. That's what he announced. But within a year, all or practically every one of them was gone. I greatly admire some of the way that Truman handled some of these officials then. For instance, the Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau, made a plan which was publicly announced, the Morgenthau Plan, a plan which would remove all factories, everything of that type from Germany, and which would reduce the German people to farmers, each of them on a little farm, if there was land enough for that, but with no ability, no opportunity to handle anything except to be poor peasants. That was the Morgenthau Plan in order to reduce the Germans to poverty and weakness forever. And he publicly announced the plan. Then President Truman announced a little later that he was going to the conference in Potsdam, I believe it was, I forget, was that or the Yalta one, that he announced that he was going there to meet with the leaders of the other allies in order to make the plans for the future. And he named the men who would go with him. And Morgenthau came to see Truman, and he said, Mr. Truman, he said, I want to be on that group that goes there to make the plans. And Truman said, Mr. Morgenthau, you are not included in the list. I've already publicly announced it. And Morgenthau said, Mr. President, I must be on that list. He said, if you do not put me on that list, I resign, effective a month from now. And Truman said, I accept your resignation, effective today. And to everyone's surprise, Truman took control in a way that no one had expected, because it was pretty much accident that he had become vice president just a month or two before he became president. And people didn't expect him to have much initiative or much power, but he took control of things in a way that very few presidents had. However, he did not immediately do it. With both presidents, the cabinet would all of them have stayed on quite a bit longer. But his policies were very different from Roosevelt's at many points, and he eventually arranged things in such a way as to have his policies definitely carried out. Now, of course, in our system, cabinet officials are appointed by the president with the consent of the Senate. But in most countries, people in prominent positions to a large extent owe their position to to their wealth or to their standing in the community, to particular situations in which they have, that give, which they are, that give them authority. And I believe these four passages give us a clue to an important development. King Josiah, who reigned for 31 years, and Jeremiah began his prophecy in Josiah's 13th year. King Josiah, in his 18th year, led a great revival, which is described at great length in Chronicles, and there is considerable about it in the book of Kings. And so in the years between Josiah's 18th year and his 31st year, in those 13 years, we can be sure that as positions became vacant, as men died or retired or positions were vacant, Josiah filled those positions as he could with men who honored the Lord and men who desired to follow him. And the result was that when, after a three-month period in between, Jehoiakim, the son of King Josiah, became king, there were men in the important official positions whom Josiah had appointed, or whom Josiah had given special opportunities to advance. And so these men were men of the type of official that Josiah wanted. And Josiah, in his desire to do wickedness, was greatly hampered by the fact that he had a group of godly officials working with him. And they were in a position where for them to come right out and very strongly oppose the king might subject them to being killed, might subject them at least to losing their positions. But where they could do a great deal to alter his attitudes or to prevent them from being carried out. And thus we have the situation in the reign of Jehoiakim of his inheriting officials appointed by his father who were mostly godly officials. And as early as this in his reign, the fourth year of Jehoiakim's reign, when these two events happened, as early as that, Jehoiakim, while his power was very great, was greatly hampered by the strong influence of officials whom his father had appointed, many of whom had a very strong position with the people, and it would have been very difficult for Jehoiakim to have dislodged. But during the 11 years of Jehoiakim's reign, we can be sure that when one of them would die or be dismissed or make some mistake that would give Jehoiakim sufficient excuse to get rid of him, that he replaced them with ungodly men. And so when Jehoiakim died, again there was a three-month period in between, but then Zedekiah became king. And Zedekiah was not in as strong a position as Jehoiakim, because when Jehoiakim died, it was expected he would be succeeded by his son, and his son reigned 3 months. And then the Babylonian king took his son off into captivity. And for some reason, the people were greatly attached to this son, Jehoiakim. In the Hebrew, there's only a difference of one letter. The last letter is N instead of M. In the English translation, for some reason, Jehoiakim has been represented with a K and Jehoiakim with a CH in his name. Well, there's no difference in the spelling at that point in the Hebrew. But Jehoiakim reigned for 3 months, and then the Babylonian king seized him and took him off as a prisoner. And the people felt that Jehoiakim was their rightful ruler. And so when he was gone, they considered his uncle Zedekiah as merely a sort of regent, someone who was holding the throne till Jehoiakim would come back, which they expected would happen very soon. And so Jehoiakim, who's also called Coniah and also called Jokin, Jehoiakim was only there 3 months. But Zedekiah is considered as the king, and so listed and so on. But the people felt the rightful king is Jehoiakim, and he will come back soon. So when a man is considered as only filling in for his nephew, his power naturally isn't quite as great as a man who they felt was the rightful king. But Zedekiah, when he became king, doubtless had to contend with officials whom Jehoiakim had gradually gotten into power, whose character was like Jehoiakim, wicked power during 11 years before. So we have this alternation, and God used the officials to protect his prophet in Jehoiakim's reign. He used the king himself, despite his timidity, to save Jeremiah's life during the next 11 years. And those facts come out in these chapters that we looked at. We don't find anything from this chapter about the fourth question, how the book of Jeremiah was formed. But I think for real understanding of the book, we have to have an understanding of that feature of how the officials came. And by the way, another point I'd like to mention there, people often have the impression that the kings of Judah and Israel were absolute monarchs. The kings had tremendous power, but they were very far from being absolute monarchs. You remember that King Ahab, one of the most wicked kings in the history of the northern kingdom, and that King Ahab, when he wanted Naboth's vineyard, the only way he could get it, in fact, he didn't think he could get it, and we read that he sulked, and he tried to buy the vineyard. Naboth wouldn't sell it to the king, and the king just sulked, and it was his wife Jezebel who said, why do you sulk like this? After all, you're king, why don't you do something? And he said, there's nothing I can do. He clearly was not an absolute monarch. And then Jezebel, you remember, asked him to give her his royal seal and the indication so she could act in his place. And she proceeded to hire people to lie about Naboth and to say that Naboth had cursed God and the king. And through these lies, Naboth was convicted and killed, and then it was easy to get his vineyard. I think that is a very clear proof that Ahab was very far from being an absolute monarch. And incidentally, you really need that fact to understand the story of Elijah's flight. You remember when Elijah stood at Mount Carmel and faced the prophets of Baal and proved that God was the true God, and King Ahab was absolutely defeated on that occasion, and Ahab went back, and Elijah said, there's rain coming. It hadn't had rain for 3 years. Well, then we read that the next day Jezebel sent word to him and said, by this time tomorrow, you'll be in the same situation as these prophets of Baal that you killed. And Elijah was so frightened that he fled. Well, Jezebel couldn't possibly have injured Elijah at that time, when he was a great hero to the whole nation for what he had done. And even if he hadn't been, she didn't have the power. In order to get rid of Naboth, she had to hire people to tell lies. She couldn't possibly have done. And Elijah's flight then had no, it was that he was overtired, and he took it for granted that he simply was being overtired. He became frightened. Instead of trusting God, he fled. But I think that's important in all our Old Testament history. You see, you had a question? Yes. Yes, right at this point, let me say just a word about the history, which is important and I hadn't intended to give quite yet, but I was going to give. And it is stated clearly in the book of Kings and some statements about it in Chronicles. And this is important. I don't know if this is the place I intended to give it, but it is very important to have this in mind. The King Josiah, who had this great revival in the 18th year of his reign, in the 31st year of his reign, heard that Pharaoh Necho, the king of Egypt, Necho is spelled N-E-C-H-O in English, that Pharaoh Necho, the king of Egypt, was marching up through Palestine along the seacoast, heading to the north. And nobody knows why King Josiah felt that he must stop Pharaoh Necho. Whether he felt that he had no right to go through his territory without first getting his permission, or whether he felt that Pharaoh Necho was going to interfere in events to the north, that Josiah was interested in their coming out differently than Pharaoh Necho would want them to be, whatever it was. We read in Kings and Chronicles that Josiah immediately took a force and rushed north from Jerusalem to Megiddo. And Megiddo is a place where the broad plain by the seacoast narrows down to a little narrow pass. And then it's broader north of that. But there's a little pass there at Megiddo that an army would have to go through there, and where a small group could conceivably hold up a fairly large army. During the First World War, there was a rather important battle fought at that place. There have been many battles at that place, and in fact it passes into the New Testament under the word of Armageddon, which is a Greek way of saying Har Megiddo, the hill of Megiddo. It was a crucial point because it is one where it would be easy for a small force to hold up a large one. And Josiah, we read, went to that place with the number of forces he could rapidly gather together, because there had been no television reporters on the scene to give an immediate word of Pharaoh Necho's coming. He simply heard what was happening out there on the seacoast and rushed up quickly with his force. And he ordered Pharaoh Necho, who was ruler of a far greater power than he had, to not pass through that pass, but to stop. And Pharaoh Necho, it says in Kings, that Pharaoh Necho said, get out of the way. I'm not interested in you. I have nothing against you. I am coming up here. And then in Kings we have the Hebrew preposition al. I am love. We are coming up here, Al, the king of Assyria. Nothing to do with you. And that Al is translated in the King James version as against, and in the NIV as to help, which sounds quite different. But the King James translates it against. I'm coming against the king of Assyria. I'm not interested in you. And Pharaoh Necho said, you have no right to pass through here. You stop. And Necho ordered his forces forward. And the first thing that happened was that Josiah was killed. And they took Josiah's body and carried it back to Jerusalem. And the King James Version, as we noticed, says, I'm going up against the king of Assyria. And a few years ago, there were discovered cuneiform tablets which tell about the death throes of the great Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire had for several centuries been the greatest force in the Near East. They had even conquered Egypt at one time, though they hadn't held it very long. And the Babylonians had been subject to the Assyrians. They had revolted. And now the Babylonians, together with a group called the Medes, were attacking the Assyrian Empire. And they had attacked it, and they had captured the leading city, Nineveh, and destroyed it. And the Assyrians fought on until in 604 they were decisively defeated, and their whole power was ended, and they ceased to be a power after that. The Babylonians took their place as great leaders in the Near East. But evidently Pharaoh Necho, who owed his power to quite an extent to original Assyrian support, came up there to help the beleaguered Assyrian Empire. And that's made quite clear in the cuneiform tablets. And so it was declared that the Bible was wrong, which says he came up against the king of Assyria, not against you. Well, there is a clear contradiction between the history as we now know it and the statement in 1 Kings as translated in the King James Version. However, I could easily say that in the last war, the United States fought with Germany. But I could equally truly say that the United States fought with England and France against Germany. I could use with in either sense. Prepositions often have a rather wide range of meaning. And this preposition, al, very frequently has the method concerning or about. It also may mean upon or near, and it is used to mean against. You may say, what a crazy language that one word has such a range of meanings, but I mentioned the range of our English with, and take the English by. I visited a man who lived by the side of the road, and I was planning to get there by Christmas. Well, what's the by mean in the two cases? The by, our English by, has about a dozen different possible meanings. In every language, prepositions are one of the hardest things to know exactly what range of meaning they cover. And so this preposition al can just as well mean concerning as against. And as they say, the NIV translates it equally correctly with the King James. King James isn't wrong in its translation. You have to pick to within the range of meaning of it. And the one they picked falls outside of what we now know was clearly intended by it. Many people say, why bother to learn Hebrew and Greek? Your English Bible certainly gives you what the Bible says, and certainly the truths of God are clear enough in the English Bible that anyone can get all that is necessary for salvation from it. But when it gets into precise understanding of many points, the English cannot exactly represent the original. And you don't learn Hebrew or Greek because you expect to make a better translation than you have. You learn it because you can see at a glance possibilities of meaning in the original that cannot all be put into any translation. And you can also see that certain possibilities of your English may be definitely ruled out by what is there. Even though the English may be a good translation, it inevitably brings in ideas not in the original and leaves out some ideas in the original, and that is true of any translation from one language to another language. But this was the death of Pharaoh Necho then, so Pharaoh Necho had no chance to designate who should succeed him. And, thank you, Josiah. And so, when Josiah died, the people of the land passed over the oldest son, Jehoiakim. And they took a younger son, named Jehoahaz, and also called Shalom in the assignment for next time he's called Shalom. And they passed over Jehoiakim, the oldest son, and took this younger son, who they evidently thought was a better man, and made him king. But after Pharaoh Necho had carried on some warfare in the north, he made a trip back to Egypt, perhaps to get additional forces, because he continued fighting up there for a few years, off and on. But on the way, he stopped in Jerusalem, And he seized, Josiah having opposed him this way, he seized the man whom the people had made king and carried him off to Egypt. And took him there and took the oldest son, Jehoiakim, and made him king instead and made him swear to be loyal to Pharaoh Necho, to whatever Pharaoh might desire. And so that's the way that Jehoiakim became king, and Josiah had nothing to say about it. Then Jehoiakim reigned 11 years, and after that, when he died, the people were very fond of his son Jehoiakim. Just why, we don't know, because we don't know enough about it. He reigned for 3 months, and at the end of the 3 months that he reigned, the king of Babylon came, and he carried him off to Babylon. And when he was taken, they took his uncle, another son of Josiah, named Zedekiah, evidently a rather timid man, but a man whose desire was to be a good king, but who in actuality proved to be an evil king because of the, principally of the strength of his officials, either in doing what they wanted or in leading him to do what they wanted him to do. So he's called an evil king in the list of kings. But in each case, the previous king had no say under the circumstances that occurred in determining who the successor would be. Now, I think this is a very interesting thing, the way that the influence of each of these kings carried over into the next reign through the officials whom they had appointed. And it would be pretty hard to understand these things, these events in Jeremiah's life without them. So much for the review of these matters and the certain additional points that I've given you, which will be helpful in connection with the assignment next time. You will find what Jeremiah says about certain kings in that chapter. And I think you will find it to be a somewhat shorter assignment than the one I gave last time. Please get it in by noon. Now, we looked last time at the call of Jeremiah in chapter 1. And that call of Jeremiah, we noticed, contained a definite prediction of the downfall of Jerusalem in verse 14. Here was a specific prediction. Their kings, that is the kings of the northern kingdoms, will come and set up their thrones in the entrance of the gates of Jerusalem. They will set up their thrones in the entrance of the gates. In ancient times, that's where business was conducted, was in the gates. We find many places in the Old Testament where we read of events that occurred in the gates, at the gate. And so we read in chapter 39 the names of the officials who would sit there at the gates as they determined what they would do with Jerusalem after it had been taken. So there was a specific prediction in that verse, which was literally fulfilled. And then he continues, I will pronounce my judgments on my people because of their wickedness. But in verse 17, he continues speaking to Jeremiah. And the last three verses of this chapter give a promise to Jeremiah, a tremendous promise. I promise that he says in verse 18, today I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar, and a bronze wall. Now, anybody who says we've got to take everything in the Bible literally can tell me how Jeremiah became an iron pillar and a bronze wall. It is much clearer than if he said, I will make you very strong so you cannot be destroyed. It is clearer and more beautiful, but it is figurative language. I always say that a figurative language is like salt. You put salt in a dish and you add greatly to the tastefulness of the dish. But you pour a whole bucket of salt in and you completely ruin it. And when somebody says, Revelation is a symbolic book, everything in it is a symbol for something else, he is reducing the book to just a collection of words that anybody can make mean anything they want. And of course, the Lord does not give revelations of that type. His revelations may include figurative language, but the greater part of them must inevitably be in literal language. But figurative language adds greatly to the beauty of any production and also may add to its understandability, because in a good figure you can often give a lot of meaning which would take many words perhaps to say. And so he says he's going to make Jeremiah a fortified city, an iron pillar, and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but will not overcome you. That's a tremendous literal prediction. It is a prediction specifically given to Jeremiah. Now, in chapter 26, you read how there was another prophet who gave substantially the same prophecy Jeremiah did, and the king sent to Egypt and got him and brought him back and killed him. So we see this is a prediction, not in general, that anyone who stands for God they will fight against but will not overcome. God may choose to have us suffer or die for his cause. Very often through a martyr, God has done much through someone's death or through someone's seeming failure. We cannot tell by whether God gives us apparent success or apparent failure, whether we really were true to him or not. But God says in the case of Jeremiah that Jeremiah would not be overcome because God was with him and would rescue him. And we can be sure that if God has a specific thing for us to do, he will protect us till we fulfill the task. But we do not know but what, through our apparent failure, if we're doing our best and keeping our eyes on the Lord and trying to serve him in all things, our apparent failure may really be what God has in mind and something through which he uses us. So God wants us to keep our eyes on the Lord and be conscious of his presence and overruling power at all times, and to trust him to give us success in what we undertake if that's his will, and to give us contentment and peace of mind if that is not his will, because it may be his will through our failures to accomplish instead of through our successes. Well, you have the assignment for next time, and we continue there tomorrow.
You yep. only want us to
just to name
state it. Where we find out information, but not state the information.
Well, no. State where we find the information.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You are chapter 26. Yes, I didn't see the chapter. Does it say specifically that Jehoiakim wanted Jeremiah, that the more the people wanted to? At before